Hey everybody, this is the podcast, and guess what? It's brought to you by Gamban. Gamban is your friend. Gamban will comfort you, give you a big old hug, and keep you away from online gambling because, you know, who wants to gamble online and lose your money and have to struggle with the gambling addiction? That's not fun for anybody. Trust me, I know. So I just think you should check out Gamban.com and use them because using them supports them and that supports the podcast. And I very much appreciate it. Also want to give my love to Epic Risk Management for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. This episode stars Elizabeth Thielen. Elizabeth is a person who works as an addictions counselor with regard to gambling addiction. She's also somebody with lived experience with gambling harm. And she's also a former amateur boxer, so we had a lot to talk about in this episode. And she will be presenting at the National Council on Problem Gambling's annual conference that's coming up, tomorrow, July 20th. And I'm presenting tomorrow, July 20th as well. Today is July 19th. This podcast is posted. So I will come back from the conference with plenty to say, I'm sure. Poor Jeff isn't able to go to the conference, otherwise he would join me and have plenty to say. So I think he'll probably just join me for a recap episode where I just tell him everything that happened, and we'll have a good old time. But in the meantime, enjoy this episode with Elizabeth Thielen, and I hope you all come back for the next episode. There are a few. I'm just rambling right now, but you know what? These episodes are fewer and farther between right now because I have that day job working as a peer specialist with regard to gambling harm. So that's why there have been fewer episodes. I'm still trying to nudge them in there. I also have a newborn child who's 4 weeks old. So there's a lot going on. So forgive me if I don't get as many episodes out. But right now, enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to All in the Addicted Gamblers podcast. My name is Brian and I have not placed a bet since July of 2014. And with me today from Nakasa in Illinois, a former athlete as well as somebody who has struggled with gambling addiction, Elizabeth Thielen is here to talk about many things, many things, but most importantly about gambling harm. So Elizabeth, thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Would you tell everybody what state you're in and the organization that you work for as a counselor and the helpline that is associated with that state?
Sure. Well, I am a problem and compulsive gambling counselor at Nicasa Behavioral Health Services. We're up in Lake County, Illinois. And in Illinois, it's really nice that we have a 24/7 hotline, 1-800-GAMBLER, which I know a lot of states utilize. And the number is 1-800-426-2537. But the helpline staff can also be reached by texting ILGAMB to, all of a sudden I'm losing that, but by live chat at the weknowthefeeling.org website. So that's what's mostly been used, is the live chat or the 24/7 hotline.
Okay. And that, I like when people say 1-800-GAMBLER, but then give the number, because I'm sure there's always people, so is there somebody frustrated, like, now I have to look it up.
Right.
What exactly I'm punching in. So how did you get to be a counselor?
Well, so I come from a family history of alcoholism. And so it's always been important to me to really be part of helping people who want to make changes around substance use. So I worked in addictions counseling right out of grad school, and that's what I've always been doing. And it's really interesting, my pathway. One of the things I love about my agency is that we serve a lot of populations. We don't just do one thing. We're always trying to meet the needs of the community. And so we've had a gambling program for about 20 years. And when the woman who was overseeing it retired, they asked me to take it over. And at the, you know, at the time, they had no idea that I had had a history with problem gambling. So I said yes, because I'm somebody who, you know, is always trying to pitch in and help. And I had no idea how important the work was. And it's really where my heart is and will always be now.
So you are a former, and it's your word, amateur boxer.
Right.
But that was, I take it, your status as a boxer, you were amateur status. What makes you amateur status versus professional status?
Amateur meaning you don't get paid.
Okay.
Right. And you wear headgear, you know, and so there are other safety regulations and that sort of thing. As an amateur athlete, you usually would be on a sanctioned card that's sanctioned by USA Boxing, which, people who go to the Olympics would qualify through USA Boxing tournaments.
So was that your goal, was to get to the Olympics?
Well, so women's boxing was not in the Olympics when I was boxing. It was not yet. And I'm old, I'm almost 50 now. So back then, the most you could get to was nationals. And I actually was able to participate and win the first national championship that USA Boxing put on for women in 1997. So
you won the very first one?
Yes.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So it was a lot of fun. And I will say, you know, looking back, I was good. Part of me just thinks that I will always be good. And I step in the ring from time to time and I go, I'm not good anymore. but it was a lot of fun. I got to meet a lot of really neat people and had some real success as far as I could go at that time.
So an amateur boxer, were you doing this during your time as an addictions counselor?
No, I was actually in college at the time. So I was attending college and grad school during this time. I was working part-time. You know, it just fit into a very kind of driven lifestyle. I made the dean's list every semester. I just was just this very competitive and driven person, definitely during that time in my life.
And so how did you get into boxing? How did you get into boxing?
Well, I had started out in martial arts many years earlier, and over time, you just keep competing with the same people time after time. And it's just kind of like, why am I still doing this? And this was something that helped me take it to the next level. My stepfather also had helped train boxers when he was in college. So we had already always hit the, you know, bags and hit the pads and that sort of thing. So I had a real love for the sport from early on.
Wow. Mm-hmm. It's like gambling. Your first time you went out and won the national tournament. I remember winning at gambling and feeling like, this is amazing. I can do this every time. Is it the same way? And like you won it and you went, I could do this every time.
Yeah. And so, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty there weren't a lot of women boxing at the time. So I would go, I mean, I boxed for over 5 years. I only had 11 matches total. So you just train 6 days a week, you always had to be on because you never knew when they would finally get a match for you. So I really had no idea. I trained for 9 months before I got my first fight, and I had no idea how I was going to do. And actually my opponent, and if you saw me then and see me now, very unassuming and not intimidating to anybody. And my opponent was much bigger as they sometimes are. You take what you can get, and very rough and tumble, and saw passed me in the hallway and said, I'm fighting her, I'm gonna kick her. And I actually looked at her and I said, you might, I don't know. Actually that was a second round knockout. I broke her nose. And from there on, there is this just amazing adrenaline that comes with getting ready and walking to the ring, and it's somewhat unparalleled, but it's not. I mean, I had a very similar experience on the way to the casino, on the way to the table once I got into the casino. And so for many athletes who their careers are over for whatever reason, it can be hard to replicate that heart pounding adrenaline rush experience. And sometimes we find ways to get that are not healthy for us.
Yes. So let's talk about that. When did gambling enter your world?
Sure. Actually really early. So my parents divorced when I was very young, and my mother remarried into a wonderfully loving Italian American family. They fed us and they loved us. And they also really enjoyed gambling. There would be, cards and dice in the garage and dollar poker, you know, we'd get dollars and look at the serial numbers and use those as like poker hands. And whoever had the better hand from the serial number got all the dollars. And this was just a very early experience for me, go play bingo and buy the pull tabs at the bingo parlor. And I would be the one always running back after, you know, spending the money I had been given and ask for more money so I could buy more of these tickets. So it was a real early exposure. And that family themselves enjoyed gambling. It was part of their recreation. And they did it the way that people are supposed to do it. They stepped away from it. They didn't do it again for a long time until it just came up naturally again. And so, you know, part of me thought, okay, that's how you're supposed to do it. My own wiring that I brought to the equation, unfortunately, made me less able to do that than the examples that I had been given.
So as an adult, when did you start gambling?
So, you know, right around 21 would be when I'd go to casinos and mostly with family. Now, where I lived at the time, where I was in college, you know, we'd have to go up to Niagara Falls, Canada. And so it wasn't like it was around the corner. So it would be an actual trip, you know, to go there or to go to Las Vegas, sometimes to Connecticut. There was a period of time where my parents lived in Cape Cod and I'd visit them and we'd go up to Connecticut. And so it was, I would say, episodic. As a counselor, I would say at that time in my life, it was episodic and mostly with family. But then I started to go on my own, especially after my boxing career ended, and it ended abruptly. And I was on the pathway to go to turn pro. And I was talking to somebody about turning professional. Because like I said, I got to nationals and there was really nowhere to go from there. You couldn't go to the Olympics. I had fought in the Golden Gloves. And so that was the next step. And it was a pretty serious injury. I still have a plate in my arm and six screws. And so it ended up so abruptly. I went from really intense training regimen to not being able, I mean, I couldn't land my straight left, which was the money shot, you know, and couldn't land it because there was just excruciating pain every time I landed it. So I went to nothing. And so, you know, there became a period of time where I would start going by myself to the casino and nobody knew about it. It wasn't until I moved to Illinois where that the casinos were right there. So that's when I started gambling more frequently, when it was just much more readily available around me.
Okay. And then when did you first notice, like, oh, this is not gelling well with me. I'm experiencing harm from my gambling.
I will have to tell you, honestly, it was something that was very uncomfortable and confusing and shameful. But even with my education and even with my profession, I didn't see it. I did not see it. In my whole life, I've been basically terrified of addiction. I don't drink alcohol, not a drop. I've never used a drug in my life. Because of what I experienced as a child of alcoholism, I just am so averse and worried about developing an addiction myself. And I still didn't see it. I didn't see gambling as risky, even though I had the sleepless nights and the financial problems and all of that. Somehow there wasn't this, you've got to stop doing this. And so when my life changed dramatically, I became engaged and my soon-to-be husband had a very young child. And so I was going to be a mother too. And my finances were a mess. And we would go to the casino using my comp card because I had much comps, you know, and go out and eat, and it would be on the comps. And at first it was kind of cool. And I felt like a hot shot, you know, and he knew that I had gambled. We'd gone a couple of times together. And after going so many times on the comps, he turned to me one day and had a look on his face and he goes, how much do you gamble? And that honestly was the moment where I was like, oh my gosh, I was right. Mortified and terrified, because that was the moment I linked it to like a problem. And it's odd to me that I didn't see it, but I've met many people who say, I'm in recovery 30 years from alcohol. I cannot believe I didn't realize what was happening with gambling. And for some reason, we just don't see it. So I didn't see it. And for me, then it was like an abrupt, I cannot do this. And very shameful and embarrassing. I put it away in a box. And I think I only went back one time. I can recall exactly. It was March 17th because it was St. Patrick's Day. And like the whole issue of luck is a whole thing we could talk about. So I remember that. And I went with my husband and some family members, and my husband would be what you would call like a normal or a controlled gambler. So he put like $40 in a slot machine and lost, and he goes, "Ugh, let's get out of here." Right. And I had just been at the table, and I think I played like three hands, and I was down almost $100 in these three hands. And I was like, "What?" You know, and I was like, you know, here I am trying to be the normal controlled gambler. And it was excruciating to just get up and leave. You know, that is not the way I would have ever played. It would have just been like, you just keep going. You go back to the ATM if you need to, you just see it through. I'm not leaving after three hands. So that for me, that time was telling, like, you just don't have it in you to be a controlled gambler. And even if you could, it sucked for me. I did not enjoy that experience at all. So for me, not for everybody, but for me, it is just that's just not for me. I just can't do it. Don't want to do it. Not a part of my life.
So you were able to stop. I don't want to say easily, but
as I told you before we came on, it's not something that I've talked about a lot. And one of my apprehensions to talk about it is it was an immediate lifting from me. And I know that that is not everyone's experience. And for many people, it's like a daily struggle. And I never want to say something that could hurt somebody. And so I've been apprehensive to say, like, this was so stark reality check for me that it was immediate. You just can't do this. And there's very few times where I feel the pull. And I will acknowledge the pull happens from time to time. And one example would be like you've heard of drug dreams. Once in a while could have a gambling dream. And not often. It's like,
I've had a lot.
Well, maybe once or twice a year. It's not often. And then there's that like slight pull and then it goes away and I write it out. And so I know that that is not many people's experience. But for me, that's what it is. And also I've built a life that is extremely incompatible with going back. I talk about the work that I do. I talk about problem gambling prevention. Anywhere and everywhere I go, professionally, personally, recreationally, people know me as the person that doesn't shut up about this. So it's kind of like just this constant, prophylactic, to be honest. It's like, it is, I'm setting up a world where if I were to gamble, I feel like everybody would go, "What are you doing?" You know?
Right.
Yeah.
So I sounds like you're being accountable to different people. I use the podcast the same way. I was like, I wouldn't gamble again, even just because of the podcast at this point.
Right.
So I totally understand that. Mm-hmm. When in the timeline of things, were you already at working with problem gambling services when you stopped gambling?
No, before. So I stopped before. And then when they gave, I would say 3 years before.
Three, okay.
And when they turned the program over to me, and we had this lovely lady from the state come in, and she trained our whole staff and everything. And I'm sitting there, and I don't know if you remember that song, like Killing Me Softly, where they say person's like talk, and the person feels like that person who can see right into them and talking to them. That's what I kind of felt like. Oh my gosh. Can you tell by looking at me? Are you're talking about things that I did? And so I still had this like compartmentalized secret shame, and it has become over the years, you know, at a certain point, you know, you talk about no one is immune to this happening, and it can happen to anybody. And there's lots of reasons it happens to people. So why am I, you know, just holding this close to the vest, you know? And so I am just deciding, I am who I am. What happened. And it informs a lot of the work that I do and how I do it.
Yeah. It's so helpful when you hear somebody else go, and you know, as you put it, you're saying this now, you weren't always telling people before that you had this problem with gambling, but now you're doing it. And I think that's cool, because then people go, "Oh my gosh,
right.
We had no idea."
And right.
Here it is. And so it just shows, you know, like this happens to anybody and everybody.
Right. And so many people this happens to, and one, they don't, I mean, we really have a lot of work to do with awareness, and that's one of my passions. People don't even know that such a thing exists. So it's hard to know that you are struggling with something when you've never even heard that it exists. But then there's this sense of I should know better, or, you know, I am in this particular profession or this role in my family or in my community, and there's just so much shame. And, you know, there's no one type of person that could not have this happen to them, who could not, you know, have just whatever coalition of factors that led to it happening. No one is immune, and it doesn't make you flawed or immoral or weak or stupid. And so I think it is important for people of all walks of life to be able to say, you know, this happened to me. And for some people, and I've heard on your podcast, some people, the looking back to say, why did this happen to me is important. And for other people, it's not. And that's another thing. I always empower people. If it's important to you, we'll look at it. If it's not, then let's not, but let's revisit if it seems like not having understood that is a obstacle for you. So for me, one, the family history, you know, two, the early exposure. And that, again, informs the work that I do. I do a lot of work around in trying to educate adults to not encourage or allow children or minors to participate in gambling, whether it's giving them lottery tickets, in birthday cards, or letting them play sports bets. I mean, we used to go as a family to the track, and I used to get to pick the horses and that sort of thing. You know, people didn't know better. And they still don't, but they can. You know, we've made a lot of headway with like social hosting laws and stuff like that for alcohol. We need to do, and I'm not saying we need, it needs to be like this legal consequence kind of thing, but we've made so much headway in public awareness of that, and we need to do that with gambling as well. So just going back to that early exposure, and then me as an athlete and the characteristics that I shouldn't say had, because I told you I'm almost 50, and I say this in many of my workshops, I will arm wrestle you. We're on Zoom, but like if you're in person, I'd be like, I could take them. It's this sometimes for many athletes, it's like it's a trait that led them into athletics. It didn't just arise there and then go away when their career went over. We have a lot of traits that follow us through our entire lives that can, in a gambling setting, be very maladaptive.
So what kind of traits make an athlete susceptible to gambling or other addictions?
Well, you know, we've talked about, you always hear about the adrenaline, and the adrenaline is like a real thing. And just like a drug or alcohol, your tolerance can go up. So it really can often require like a higher intensity experience in order to feel that. And so when the career is over, how do you, in any kind of way, get that again, that can lead to all sorts of risk-taking behavior. So that's one. But the other is just this sense of identity as like a winner, you know? And it's like, you have to win in all things. You have to be better than, and this is how we like psych ourselves up. And I use the example of, if you see the people who come out, whether they're mixed martial artists or boxers, they come out to a fight song, and it's never like, you're wonderful and graceful. It's like, I'm going to destroy you. You know, yeah. It's like very intense. I'm better than everybody. And this is a mindset that can really help somebody to perform better. And so if I'm gambling and I lose, it's very incompatible with how I see myself as a person. And so there's this need to just get back and winning. And we know that chasing losses is a very symptomatic behavior for disorder gambling. So that's definitely one. And the flip side of that is, I'm not a loser, you know, like that's, you know, something that's not comfortable for an athlete to embrace. And so if you win in sports, you keep going, you try to win, you know, you win locally, you go to state, you go to national. If you're an Olympic athlete, you you know, want to get that gold medal. You get a gold medal. That's not the end. Let's be a multi gold medalist, you know? And so there's never a big enough win. And I think many gamblers can relate with that, that, you know, chasing the wins, you know, also happens. And then as an athlete, when you are losing, you don't quit. It's not an athlete's mentality to go, I'm losing, I'm going to quit. Just like I gave the example of my husband losing $40 and saying, let's go. But an athlete has this mindset, I got to dig deep. I got to fight harder, you know? And if you're gambling, that's not what to do. Like a normal, non-disordered way of gambling is if you're down, then you leave, you know? If you're up, you leave. You know, you're just done with it, you know? And so we kind of have these mindsets that have us gambling in a way that is really, really unhealthy. And I also point to the preoccupation. Preoccupation is another symptom, as we know, of disordered gambling. And that's like this visualization of, you know, playing, winning, all of that, fantasizing. But athletes do that very, very well and very naturally. You know, we imagine ourselves in the ring or on the field or, you know, and whatever the sport is, there's this very, very high degree of visualization. And I believe that we have that skill that, unfortunately, if transferred to gambling, makes that preoccupation very, very compelling and very realistic. Those are just a few, but yeah. You mentioned I have a blog, it's fightproblemgambling.com, and I talk about those kinds of things and some other traits. And then I digress a lot because I just tend to do that.
But yeah, we'll link it in. I love the title, fightproblemgambling.com. I was when I was looking at your information on LinkedIn, I saw it and I was like, oh my gosh, she's got a website and it's literally Fight Problem Gambling. I never found you before?
Because I'm not great about, like, you know, connecting and getting stuff out beyond, you know, the circle. And I think that we're all doing better as a field of maybe trying to get outside of our little bubbles and something really cool. And here I say, I would digress. Here I go. I have a colleague who's come in and spoken to our communities about problem gambling, and she was traveling abroad and has a colleague in Egypt who, there was a student at their community psychology program who needed to do a service project for a social service agency. She says, do you want to work with them? I was like, yes. So, I gave her information that the local or the most recent research here out of Illinois on disordered gambling, I sent her the materials that our teen problem gambling prevention group had created. She mulled it all over and came up with some recommendations and ideas for us, sent them over in video form. And we are using her, you know, her ideas to do a social media campaign to try to raise awareness of underage gambling and the risks of that. And so this is what I'm talking about, that I do think things have changed so much during COVID for the better as far as information sharing and connecting people, even from across the globe. I just think that's really cool. And it really provides an opportunity for people who are suffering in silence to not be doing that anymore.
And is that what you're doing with the agility grant?
Yeah. So that's a segue instead of a digression. Yeah. So definitely we were so honored to be one of the first four recipients of an agility grant through the National Council on Problem Gambling. And it's to expand what we had already started with a teen problem gambling prevention group. And this is allowing us to bring in more members and have a farther reach for the program. And we're only in the first few months, but they're already doing really cool things. Like I said, using stuff from across the world, building on that, they've already developed a social media campaign for Instagram where they're going to be encouraging youth to make posts about positive activities that they participate in instead of gambling. And they've created a hashtag that goes along with it so that we can maybe, you know, get people from all over, young people from all over joining this campaign and promoting positive activities versus underage gambling. So it's a really, that's just one aspect of the program. It's really to educate the community, including the adults, about the risk of underage gambling, and they're doing just amazing work already. It's really cool.
And so for the National Council on Problem Gambling's conference that you're presenting at, and that I am attending, what are you presenting on? Is it the agility grant and just how it all works?
I'm going to be presenting on what the teams have done so far and what they plan to do. And so I haven't talked to them yet to see if I can show pictures and stuff, but I really hope so. I mean, they've created videos and I want to be able to have some images from the social media posts and some of the events. They've got a couple of events loosely organized coming up, including walking in a parade and handing out information to the adults in the crowd and that sort of thing.
Oh, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. And are you presenting with someone?
I'm just presenting myself.
Just yourself.
And,
okay.
Yeah, just myself. And you know, the really cool thing is we had invited a couple of the teens, like, hey, do you want to come to this? And you know what? They're like, that's all right. They're really busy and they're not doing this for self-promotion. They're just doing it when they decided and they learn more. They're like, oh, this is important. We got to do this. So they're just busy doing the work, you know, and they're not interested in showing off or anything like that. And I don't know. I just think that is telling that they were just like, no, that's all right. You just go. You
know? Humble kids.
Yeah. Yeah, they're amazing.
So when you talk about digressing on your blog.
Yeah.
So you are a counselor who works to help people with who have experienced gambling harm. Mm-hmm. And so I think either I read or it's in my head that you're probably neutral on the subject of gambling itself.
Right. Yeah. And I actually come to that not just out of like a policy decision. I come to that from, I grew up with people who did it the right way. Yeah. And I would never say that nobody should be able to do that if they choose to, because they can. But I also know that not everybody can. And, you know, if I'm going to Monday morning quarterback my whole situation, like there's a lot of things that could have been done differently had any of us known about this. So it is my passion to make sure that, you know, literally everybody who has, you know, any opportunity to gamble, to obviously know anybody who might gamble, needs to be informed of the risks, needs to know what are some of their unique risk factors. Because, you know, somebody with all, you know, I checked a lot of boxes coming into this, that might have been a time to go, oh, this is probably not for you. This is probably something you need to stay away from. Or if I chose to do it anyway, could I have known, like, what are some of the warning signs? Because like I said, I didn't even know until really, you know, probably close to 15 years in that this was a problem. Like, I didn't even see it. I hadn't even heard of problem gambling, you know? So right. I think we need to equip people and empower people to make decisions that work for them and to use resources and tools that are out there to have like a checks and balances, to have a safer way of doing it if they do choose to participate, but also that they can really, really quickly shift gears if they go, oh, wow, you know, I don't even have any of these risk factors, but this is happening. So what am I going to do about it? And to very non-judgmentally provide quick and easy access to support and information so that people can make decisions that are lower risk. And so, yeah, that neutrality is not necessarily just external. That is something that I do internalize. And I do also think, you know, I say all the time, when we get people come into our program, they've come to us following suicide attempts, you know, prison sentences or facing indictment and divorce papers and home foreclosures. And I always say, you were 100% of the time going to pull you in and do what we can with you. Sure would have liked to meet you a little earlier though, you know? And so I think if we take a very, like, whether it's anti-gambling or everybody who comes to us has to quit, we lose all those opportunities earlier on to say, let's just look at it. Let's look at it, see what's happening, give you some options to try, keep adjusting, you know. And even if somebody has, like, let's say they want to have a controlled form of gambling in their life, that doesn't mean from now to the end of time, that's what they need to do. because they can have loss, they can have job loss, they can have a medical problem, they can have trauma. There's any number of things that can then contribute to somebody who was doing it in a controlled way becoming uncontrolled. And, you know, even in when I go out and do public awareness, even regarding alcohol, like if somebody's physician said, you need to drink in moderation, and if they actually went so far as to say what that means, because I don't think that's a something that happens frequently, like, okay, was it no more than two alcoholic beverages per whatever time frame? That person's body and life continues to change. So what it was at age 30 does not apply at age 60. And that, so it constantly needs to be revisited and examined as far as, you know, what is appropriate and I don't want to say healthy, because I wouldn't go so far as to say that that would be a healthy, you know, activity, but to be able to say, no, this needs to really be looked at and scaled back, or this is the time to not do this anymore.
Yeah. Let me ask first, what does gambling look like in Illinois?
It's changed a lot. And so, you know, you had your tracks, lottery, riverboat gambling, which is in itself changed as far as, you know, used to have to debark or whatever the name was, like the period of time where it had to be closed officially, like, and pull up the plank or whatever, you know, because they had to be on a riverboat, and I mean on a river, a waterway. And then, you know, and I want to say it was around 2013, video slots and video poker. And so that has created a lot of changing landscape. And then of course, legalization of sports wagering is very recent. And then just a lot of online gambling in general. And, you know, we could spend a whole different podcast on the cryptocurrency and day trading and all of these activities that are technically gambling, but very much not recognized as nor regulated as. And so it's changing so, so fast. And one really excellent thing that has happened is, for the first time ever, the state funded a statewide impact study to say, what is the impact of gambling right now on Illinois? It's the first time ever. And the findings, we could go through a whole thing on that, and maybe that would be a great topic. One of the most prominent ones that was found was that over 1 million Illinoisans either have active gambling problem or at-risk gambling. So that's a lot of people. Wow. And we've all heard the equation: for every problem gambler, there's at least 8 people in their lives significantly impacted. So that now we're talking like another 8 million Illinoisans significantly impacted by somebody else's gambling. So that's a lot. And so, you know, what does it look like? It's ever changing. I think there's a lot of new gamblers coming to the market, and this is exactly what I'm talking about. If we have this anti-gambling stance, or everybody needs to not gamble, and then you've got like sports wagering and all these new things coming in, and we don't talk to these people until they dug in their heels and really, really got involved and then developed problems, we missed out on the opportunity to say, hey, hang on, if you're going to do this, let's do some bit of assessing what your risks are, you know, so you can decide whether or not to, and let's make sure you have, you know, some safeguards in place to, you know, try to do this in a controlled way. You even know what that looks like, and some checks and balances for if it doesn't, what are you going to do about it? So I think this study really does help highlight that the impact is great already. There is a corresponding allocation of resources. So the treatment providers are growing, which is great. And I'm one of only about 70 certified gambling counselors in Illinois, but there are many, many more coming on board, many with additional training who just haven't sought certification yet. And that wasn't always the case. So, you know, the state is really trying to expand the resources so that those who need care will have somewhere to go, as well as, you know, telehealth being so widely accepted and supported now. we see people from very remote areas in Illinois that just don't have another treatment provider anywhere near them that they can work with. And so that this is opening up the doors for people to get care who otherwise felt very isolated.
Does Illinois pay for the treatment at all? Any sessions, are they covered?
Yeah. And so in Illinois, if a person does reach out to a state contracted provider, every provider who is state contracted has funding to fund that service, and how they do that might vary. But at our agency, we charge no copay, because we've even found, you know, if you say $25 for an evaluation, that might be the thing that somebody just says, oh, well, I'll come another time. And so it's not worth it. If somebody has financial hardship due to gambling, they will be able to get those services at no cost to them. And that's the case for many of the providers. Some have a small copay. But one thing that the state has allowed that's very important for gamblers is, unlike other services where there's a sliding scale based on income and dependence, that's not the case for gamblers. If you have financial related harm due to gambling, you can make six figures and you could still get those services funded. And that's important, because we know having more income doesn't necessarily mean that you have anything left. It might mean you just gambled more.
And so if somebody wanted to access these services in Illinois, does it start by calling the 1-800-GAMBLER?
Yes. That's the great thing, because they can connect them not only to treatment, which is important, but to Gamblers Anonymous or self-exclusion. There is a self-exclusion program here in Illinois for casino wagering and sports wagering. And hopefully soon there will be for video slots and poker. The lottery has a process that people can go through. So the helpline can really connect them to lots of different options.
If you ask me how the advertising in my state of Connecticut is, I'd say it's everywhere all the time. How is the advertising in Illinois?
It's very similar. And so it is a concern, and our clients report it. And I myself get really, you know, I love mixed martial arts and I can't stand sitting there and instead of hearing the punch stats and I'm hearing about the odds, I don't want to hear this. This isn't, you know, and sports wagering wasn't even my thing. I'm just turned off by it. I want to be able to focus on the sport. And so it is really prevalent. And I know that it makes it difficult to get through the day and without being faced with incentives to gamble in some way. You can go pump gas and the screen will say, come on in and play slots. Or it's, you know, and there was a time prior to that where I worked with some clients where lottery was their chosen form of gambling. And there were like three gas stations in the county that didn't sell lottery products. And those were the ones where they would go to fill up, you know. And now I don't even know if there are any, you know, let alone that there's going to be video slots or poker in many of these establishments. We had a client, not me, one of the counselors here had a client who was, you know, doing great and just enjoying recovery and treated themselves to some Chinese food, and they opened the fortune cookie and got in their fortune. It was a crypto site. And then another one was online poker. And it says, play poker, win Bitcoin. And so what can you do to get around your day without encountering gambling?
Everywhere.
You just can't. And so it's really, really tough for people. And I do think that, you know, vendors of gambling products definitely need to be more aware of the impact of these kinds of advertisements on real people with real families and real jobs. You know, really be involved in the conversation of, you know, what could we do differently? Now, you have to have the helpline information on all gambling advertisements, but I can't tell you how many billboards I drive by where the only people who would be able to read that would be the people who installed the billboard. And that is not a genuine effort. And I will say, you know, I did work with a author who did an article on casino, I think it was casino.org website. And it was about how COVID impacted public awareness efforts for Problem Gambling Awareness Month. And somebody had actually said, why would you do that? That's a gambling site. And I said, because more people go to casino.org than casa.org. More gamblers go to that site. And that's the thing. Yeah. The gamblers are the ones that need this information. So if they're getting it from the establishment, from the product, that's really powerful. And I think about the NFL website, responsibleplay.org, and the advertisement that they had for that site, and they worked with NCPG to put that site up. Again, that's powerful because that's coming from just this establishment that is huge and respected. And so I do think that there are some efforts in place that need to be really amplified to get the word out in a way that reaches gamblers and potential gamblers, because sometimes I'm preaching to the choir. I'm talking to other counselors and other people who get it and who care, or who are like just right there about to care. But we need to be much more wide scale in advertising gambling help,
yeah,
you know, compared to the amount we're advertising gambling products.
Yeah, we run into the same thing with billboards here. I actually called the council the other day, or I texted the council and I said, hey, I just drove by this billboard on this highway and I can't read the number.
Right. And I was traveling home, you know, back towards the East Coast, and I had driven by one, and I won't call out who they were, but the helpline, and it was in another state, was so prominent. And then I was like, I got there and I was like emailing, like, I don't know if you care or not, but that was what needs to be done. Thank you for paying more than a nod to, you know, responsible gambling practices. They never replied. So I guess they didn't even get to the right person or whatever, but, you know, that's unfortunately kind of rare. So it's good when you see someone doing the right thing.
Yeah. I wish they'd put up the number more, and I wish they would say something. I'm not a big fan of the lines of like, when it stops being fun.
Right.
So I eye roll a lot in this, in this space, in the gambling harm space. I don't mean to, but I do. Cause I just think there's so much more that can be done than is being done. And like you said, the least you could do is make the helpline big enough so people can read it.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the least.
The least.
But I'd like to see the number in more places, and, you know, with real reasons behind why somebody would use the number.
Right.
Like, call this number if you experience stress tonight from gambling or something.
Right.
Simple.
Or something. And you're right. And I think that being able to include people with lived experience in the process of developing that wording or that sort of thing would really make a lot of sense. And, you know, we run here at our program a DUI risk reduction education program, but the people who come to it are the people who have gotten a DUI. And I get many people who come out of that and go, man, I really wish I had taken that course before I got the DUI, because I didn't know any of this stuff. And like, I didn't know you could get a DUI if you're drinking too much and you pull over and you try to sleep it off, but you're still in the vehicle. I didn't know that, you know? And so likewise, can we get to versus like, when it becomes a problem, call this number, but like, just call this number and learn. You know, can there be like this initiation or orientation process for, you know, safer strategies and what to look out for and help that's available prior to the gambling beginning?
Yeah. And at an earlier age, I hope it makes its way in. I'm sure in places that they're doing trainings. And I think I heard someone was doing trainings in a middle school even.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good that they're trying to get this out to people. But again, as a student, at that age, you kind of eye roll like, yeah, yeah, I know drugs are addictive.
Right.
Drinking's bad.
Right.
Okay. Gambling's bad too. All right. Fair enough. But
right,
most people are still going to go try it themselves and see how it goes. But I suppose if you have that information going in, then you think back to it and you go, oh, they were right. This is so addictive.
Or we can do one better, which is learn from what we know about what doesn't work with those campaigns, like the Scared Straight and Just Don't Do It, those things that don't work. But what we do know works is, you know, social norms and having youth themselves empower each other, you know, and messages of delay. And that's a big part of what we're trying to help is that, well, one, let's normalize that it's not a requirement. I mean, it's not a requirement to be a drinker. I'm not a drinker and I'm not a recovering alcoholic. I choose not to drink for very important reasons. So can we normalize that you can choose not to gamble? But can we have that message coming from other young people who are expressing why they choose not to gamble, or at least to not gamble right now? And that's part of what we're trying to do with this program, because I can talk all day and it's going to be the eye roll. It's going to be the Charlie Brown, wah, 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 coming from a middle-aged woman, you know, but if it's coming from, you know, the other kids in the high school who are about to go off to college, it has the potential to be a lot more impactful, especially if it's in a way it's coming from them. You know, yeah. We are giving these youth, we're giving them the information, we're giving them the research, and they're like digesting it and then reframing it in a way that is better received by people their own age. And that seems to be a much more effective approach.
Do you have anything to say about the effect of physical health on mental health? Because you are somebody who exercises still to this day, I would imagine. I think you've said heavily. Do you have anything to add about the making physical health impact your mental health?
Yeah, I definitely do. And I find for myself, like, keeping active is very, very important. And, you know, with all things, you have to be cautious. I have to keep an eye on my relationship to exercise and my relationship to work. You know, those are two things that I have to, you know, really just keep an eye on, given my personality traits and everything.
Because you're afraid that you'll get into it too much and it'll start to
difficult disengaging, like making it the thing, the only thing, the most important thing. And it's not, it's a piece of a, you know, a well person, you know? And so I will say that if you are someone who has this like drive in you, sometimes you can find ways to feed that drive that are healthier. And so this competitiveness, this need to win and perform is important to me. And I, you know, will compete. Like there was a period of time I was competing in CrossFit, you know, and races and things that are more appropriate and healthy for my, you know, age and my lifestyle. And at the same time, we also need to be able to be okay with just being, you know, mediocre, you know, like, and so I feel like it's a flip side, you know. I think being active and being outdoors and you know, taking care of your body can really, you know, help your mind to be at peace as well. But that mind affects the body and affects everything. And so we need to work on that mind piece too, and be okay with being bored and be okay with, you know, just things not going perfectly, because they're not going to. That's not life, you know, and to be able to say, yep, this sucks, you know, and I'm going to be okay. And I'm still here, you know, and so I definitely think it goes both ways, and finding activities that are fulfilling and satisfying. And I know I talked to you offline about one of my hobbies, which was mining and prospecting. And it is something that I've been doing since I was a child, and really have, you know, continued out through my many years. And it's something where, like, you can go to a mine and pay $15-$25 to be there all day. Physical activity, satisfying, beautiful things come of it, whether it's, you know, crystals or fossils or whatever it is that you're looking for. And you know, so I think it's a search for people to find what are those things that are enjoyable and pleasant, and how can I participate in them in a way that is healthy. And you know, what does that look like for people? And know that there's going to be some trial and error, you know. And I even, you know, I love CrossFit, and many recovering people turn to CrossFit, especially if they're just kind of like adrenaline kind of people. And then I caution people, because with that comes pain. You're going to be sore, you know, and you could have injuries. And how, you know, do you handle injuries in a way that isn't turning to something that's risky for you, you know, and know that even with those things, there can be alcohol at events, you know. What is your choice in those situations? You know, how can you be prepared and not be thrown? You're like, I'm doing this great, amazing physical activity. And then I turn around and there's like this cooler of beer there. What is that? You know, so not to be caught off guard and to make some decisions ahead of time if you're going to be cautious and choose not to participate in that part of an event.
I always like to think that people know when people say, oh, well, what's gambling? And then they go off on the tangent of life is a gamble and yeah. Getting out of bed is a gamble.
Right.
But what is gambling? And I just think, well, you know, when you're doing it, what causes you to get to that level? You know what gets you to that level mm-hmm. where it's just like gambling. Mm-hmm. So there's been games I've played or other activities that I've done that are similar to gambling mm-hmm. where I start to feel that way. And then I have to walk away from it and never do it again. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I realize it just brings out the gambling in me. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that mining can be similar to gambling before we started. How is it similar to gambling for you? Uh-huh. And how do you keep yourself from going down that rabbit hole?
Sure. So it's similar in that there is this chase, you know, there's this chase and there's this competitiveness and there's also this like real territorial nature, like just like it, you know, like this is my seat at this table or this machine or whatever. This is my spot and you better not come close because I'm swinging a 12-pound sledgehammer, you know? And so if you think about like back in the early days with the gold rush and everything, there's this like gold rush mentality and that can be risky for somebody who has, you know, the history with gambling. So is this something one to not participate in at all, or can you be more measured and careful? And I myself have to, you know, I have people who will come with me. For example, my stepson is just so great. And he's a great little mining buddy because he stays out of my way, but he's like, here, have some water, have some lemonade, eat something, you know, like this check and balance, you know, to like take breaks and go use the restroom instead of just being so involved that it's just at the expense of your body and your family, you know. So just really keeping an eye on that and, you know, enjoying it without the expense to health and wellness and family. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it has been a delight to talk with you, Elizabeth Thielen. I'm thoroughly impressed at your blog because I didn't know it existed. So I'm so excited. It's fightproblemgambling.com. If anyone wants to go there, I'll stick a link in. And then as well, you are a counselor for NACASA. You are lived experience. You have all these wonderful titles that go with you. It has been a pleasure to talk. You can come on here and Charlie Brown's mother all day long. You can want all day long. Okay. Please come back again and talk more. But before you go, I want to know, if you have anything else you'd like to say or present, but B, when you are boxing with somebody, what is the goal? Are you trying to knock them out? Are you trying to just wear them down? Mm-hmm. Or does it just depend on the partner? What does a match look like? What are you trying to do?
Well, you know, it started out very, very brutish, you know, and I only had 11 matches, 8 of them ended in knockout. You know, so I was 10-1 with 8 KOs. And so the knockout was really the goal for me. And I was often outweighed by quite a lot up until I got to the USA Boxing Nationals, where like, they're not playing. You're not doing any monkey business with the weight. I actually get to go in against people who are my size for a change. And those became a little bit more strategic and, my best fight ever actually didn't end in a knockout, went the distance, and it was just like a real chess match. And it was just, you know, get in, get out, land punches, don't get punches landed on you. And that was really amazing. And if I can digress, I will say, because you had asked somebody else, like, what's the highlight? I will talk about a highlight of this career. I actually, when I was in the preliminaries for the national championship in Augusta, Georgia in 1997, the card was filmed by ESPN2 and it was going to air, and Al Bernstein was the commentator. So for me, I was like, oh my gosh, Al Bernstein is going to commentate my fight. And this, of the whole card, my fight was the only one that ended in a knockout. And my jab was just tremendous that evening. And it was so beautiful. And I was like, I cannot wait to see and hear what Al Bernstein said. And I turn around and the cameras are gone. And he and his partner were still there, like watching. I don't think they even realized that the film crew had just packed everything up and left. And it's really telling to what women's sports were like at that time, because you would never go to a sporting event and just film the first hour and then just leave. You would film the whole thing and you put the best parts up. And so it was a bummer, but also like, that's really cool that Al Bernstein saw me fight. They'll never know whatever he thought, but I think he might have been impressed with that jab and the knockout. So anyway, it's a really exciting part of my history. And, you know, I think I take that fighter mentality into the work that I do, and you bob and you weave and you try to make an impact without it impacting you too greatly.
That's beautiful. To knock 8 of 11 out, mm-hmm. you must have a hell of a fierce punch. What? How did you develop that?
Well, as I said, my stepdad, he put the gloves on me and my sister like way early on. Like, we had a dispute in the house. He's like, lace them up. And we would just go at it in the living room with boxing gloves. And I'd hit the bag. You know, we had a punch bag in the basement, and I was small. I fought at 112 pounds. I was never weighed more than 108 at any given time. But I was a southpaw, so that helped. You know, it was for many people, a confusing stance. And I actually went against a southpaw once. I was like, what's happening? Like, I was so confused. Why is this not landing and they're landing on this? And my coach was like, she's a southpaw too, dummy. You know, like, oh, okay. And we had to mix up, you know, like switch up the strategy, and now it makes sense. But my straight left was my power hand, and it just really, sometimes I'd work the body. You know, a lot of times in amateurs, you don't see a lot, you see a lot of headhunters, but you work the body, you chop that tree down. And it really could be really effective. And I found that I needed to. I had one match in particular where I was outweighed by a lot, and the woman was a boxing coach herself. And it was just this brutal, it was just awful. And I had two black eyes and my nose was like humongous afterwards, and I won. But I had a hard time speaking after that for the rest of the night. My sentences came out like you would put them on paper, cut them up and put them in a different order. And that scared me. I was in grad school at the time. And I was like, I'm a straight A student. Like, I can't speak. So after that, I realized you got to work your head movement. You cannot be getting hit like this. And it was much more strategic after that, and not taking the damage, and just inflicting what you can while evading the rest of the time.
See, if I had heard this, maybe I would have gotten into boxing more if I had heard this earlier in my life. And like, what am I watching? You know, as opposed to just, well, they're hitting each other.
Right.
But there's clearly this art form to it. And I wish I had gotten that explanation much younger, so I could have gotten into boxing a little more.
Yeah, it can be really beautiful when you see a thinking match in there, and the fakes and the timing, and you think of the greats like Mike Tyson. He could slip a punch by like an eighth of an inch, no wasted movement, you know. And it was just, oh my gosh, if he threw a hook, like both feet were off the ground. It was like, just put everything into it, you know. It can be really beautiful to watch when it's done right.
Well, it's been so nice talking to you about this, because I'm watching this smile come across your face as you're talking about boxing. So clearly you love it. And that's awesome. That's so great. Thank you so much for joining the podcast out of the blue. I just found you out of the blue, and you were nice enough to do this. So thank you so much.
Yeah. And I really thank you. And I'm glad that we're connected, and love what you do. So thanks for doing this.
Well, and I will see you in July.
Yes, I will.
That's right. Great. And this will, we'll get this up soon, and I'll message you when it is up. Lastly, you want to give the helpline one more time?
Illinois, you can call 1-800-GAMBLER, or you can connect with the helpline staff by live chat at weknowthefeeling.org. And on that website, there are also links to that statewide impact study that I mentioned.
Oh, that's right. I wanted to see you. I had more questions. I'll ask you offline. Well, thank you, Elizabeth, and thanks everybody for listening.
This podcast is owned by Lee Street Media, LLC. Music provided by T-Vance. Remember, This is a podcast. The views expressed on the podcast are solely those of the hosts and the guests. If you need help for a gambling addiction, please seek professional help.